I'm going out to clean the pasture spring. I'll only stop to rake the leaves away and wait to watch the water clear, if I may. I shan't be gone long. You come too. I'm going out to fetch the little calf that's standing by the mother. It's so young it totters when she licks it with her tongue. I shan't be gone long. You come too. I like to begin any program of the poetry of Robert Frost with that poem. It's called The Pasture. It's a good introduction. It's an invitation into the world and life of Robert Frost. Frost used that poem as an introduction to every book of poetry that he wrote except the very first one. My name is Brad Benow. I'm a Lutheran pastor in San Diego. Have been at Holdem here for 2 weeks as a guest, and tomorrow we leave. It's been a delightful time and a great way for me to cap off the time here by sharing the poetry of Robert Frost with you. It was about 10 years ago when I was here in the village and on staff that I first really spent some serious time with Robert Frost and began to commit some of his work to memory and enjoyed it a lot. Come on in. Why don't you? I hope you'll find this evening a time when you can touch base with some of Frost's poems which you know well, hopefully get introduced to a few that you may not have heard before, and more than anything, I hope that we can all relish in the narrative quality of these poems, the stories that they tell, the images that they bring forth, and I have appreciated the opportunity to commit many of Frost's poems to memory, because it says to me that oral tradition still lives. Stories can still be remembered and told, and there's a way to do that through poetry that I just don't think any other medium really captures. Well, enough of me, let's get on with some poems. Frost was not much of a theologian, overtly, although he certainly talked about things which were deep into the meaning of life and what human beings are all about. Every now and then, though, he did touch on something, at least in a lighthearted sort of way, that was theological, and that's represented in this poem called Not All There. I turn to speak to God about the world's despair. To make bad matters worse, I found God wasn't there. God turned to speak to me. Don't anybody laugh. God found I wasn't there. At least, not over half. That poem reminds me of that sign that I saw or read about somewhere in front of the church, you know, that says, if you're not close to God, guess who moved? A longer poem. It's called Two Tramps in Mud Time. Those of you, I think, who have been in the village through the winter and now into the spring know what mud time is about. We don't have that in San Diego. You can count on one hand the number of times it rains during the year, but mud time is that time Frost is talking about in the poem here. It's long about April. It's still kind of winter, and it's not yet fully spring, but it's a no-season time. And it's in that time when he has a very interesting encounter. You'll want to listen toward the end, toward the last verse, where he really probes the depths of what life is about. But, as always, leads us through a nice story before he gets to the point. It's called Two Tramps in Mud Time. Out of the woods, two strangers came and caught me splitting wood in the yard. One of them put me off my aim by hailing cheerily, "Hit them hard!" I knew pretty well why he stayed behind and let the other go on away. I knew pretty well what he had in mind. He wanted to take my job for pay. Good blocks of oak it was I split, as large around as the chopping block. And every piece I squarely hit fell splinterless as a cloven rock. The blows that a life of self-control spares to strike for the common good. That day, giving a loose to my soul, I spent on the unimportant wood. The sun was out, but the wind was chill. You know how it is on an April day when the sun is warm and the wind is still? You're 1 month on in the middle of May. But if you so much as dare to speak, a cloud comes over the sunlit arch, A wind comes off the frozen peak and you're 2 months back in the middle of March. A bluebird comes tenderly up to alight and turns to the wind to unruffle a plume. His song so pitched so as not to excite a single flower as yet to bloom. It is snowing a flake, but he half knew winter was only playing possum. Except in color, he isn't blue, and he wouldn't advise a thing to blossom. The water, for which we may have to look in summertime with a witching wand, in every wheel rut is now a brook, in every print of hoof a pond. I'll be glad of water, but don't forget the lurking frost in the earth beneath. That will come forth after the sun is set and show on the water its crystal teeth. Well, the time when most I loved my task, these two must make me love it more by coming with what they came to ask. You'd think I'd never felt before the weight of an axe head poised aloft, the grip on earth of outspread feet, the life of muscles rocking soft and smooth and moist in vernal heat. Out of the woods, two hulking tramps from sleeping God knows where last night, but not long since in the lumber camps, they thought all chopping was theirs of right. Men of the woods and lumberjacks, they judged me by their appropriate tool. Except as a fellow handled an axe, they had no way of knowing a fool. Well, nothing on either side was said. They knew they had but to stay their stay, and all their logic would fill my head, as that I had no right to play at what was another man's work for gain. My right might be love, but theirs was need. And where the two exist in twain, theirs was the better right, agreed. But yield who will to their separation. My object in living is to unite my avocation and my vocation, as my two eyes make one in sight. Only where love and need are one, and the work is play for mortal stakes, is the deed ever really done for heaven and the future's sakes. When you move out of mud time and you get along into summer, along about June, where Frost lived in New Hampshire, he observed that by then the snow had basically melted, the runoff had gone away, and this next poem is about a brook, although, as he observes, by June, the brook has run out of song and speed. It's no more water. It's called Hyla Brook. You have to know that the word Hyla refers to a breed of frogs, so he's talking about the Hyla frogs, which would be there in the springtime, but by the time the brook has dried up in June, they're gone. It's called Hyla Brook. By June, our brooks run out of song and speed. Sought for much after that, it will be found either to have gone groping underground and taken with it all the Hyla breed that shouted in the mist a month ago like ghost of sleigh bells in a ghost of snow, or flourished and come up in jewelweed, weak foliage that is blown upon and bent even against the way its waters went. Its bed is left a faded paper sheet of dead leaves, stuck together by the heat. A brook to none but who remember long. This, as it will be seen, is other far than with brooks taken otherwhere in song. We love the things we love for what they are. If you were counting, you noticed that poem has 15 lines. It's almost a sonnet and a little bit extra at the end. I like that poem especially because of the work that I do with older adults in our parish, and I look into those lives sometimes, and it's good to have a long memory and to remember that we love the things we love for what they are, not for what they aren't, not because a life is spent and is no longer the fullness that it once was, but Because if you have a long memory, you can appreciate someone in all of their fullness, in all of their contrariness, maybe, as we're stressing through the theme here. Well, Frost was not always so serious, often lighthearted. He grew up, I didn't know this until I really started reading into his life, he grew up in San Francisco, was born on the West Coast before he moved to New England. We often think of him, you know, as a New England poet. And in his younger years, his father, William Prescott Frost, was a bit of a roguish kind of a person, heavily involved in local politics, probably knew some people who were, you know, not the kind of folks you necessarily would think Frost might have associated with. And I like to think that this next poem probably came out of those early years when his father took him around to saloons and political meetings and smoke-filled rooms and so forth. It's called In Dives Dive. It's late at night, and still I am losing. But still I am steady and unaccusing. As long as the Declaration guards my right to be equal in number of cards, it is nothing to me who runs this dive. Let's have a look at another five. Well, Frost, as you know, grew up in the early part of this century, wrote poetry through the middle part of this century, died eventually in 1963, well into his 80s. This next poem, well, it's called Neither Out Far Nor In Deep. I'll tell you in a second when we're done why I think it's appropriate when he wrote it. It's about the ocean, and any of you who have ever, you know, even walked casually on the shore have seen this phenomenon. What do people look at? Not the land. They look into the water. Well, here's Frost's commentary. Neither out far nor in deep. The people along the shore all turn and look one way. They turn their back on the land. They look at the sea all day. As long as it takes to pass, a ship keeps raising its hull. And the wetter sand, like glass, reflects a standing gull. Well, the land may vary more, but wherever the truth may be, the water comes ashore and people look at the sea. They cannot look out far, they cannot look in deep, but when was that ever a bar to any watch they keep? He wrote it before the time of television, but I think it could be very appropriately applied. Everything around us may be of infinitely more interest, but there we sit and watch, you know. We can't look in far, you can't certainly look too deep, but there it is. It's commentary on our modern lifestyle. Well, in several poems we'll share tonight, we'll find the poet conversing with all kinds of different things. But in this next poem, he's in a bit of conversation, well, as the title of the poem says, a considerable speck, the most minuscule of insects, written as only a poet could write, and written for any of you who have ever taught, graded theme papers, graded any kind of papers. You'll have to listen for the very last couple of lines to get what he's really driving at, but I think it'll all come clear. It's called A Considerable Speck. A speck that would have been beneath my sight on any but a paper sheet so white, set off across what I had written there. And I had idly poised my pen in air to stop it with a period of ink, when something strange about it made me think that this was no dust speck by my breathing blown, but unmistakably a living mite with inclinations it could call its own. It paused, as with suspicion of my pen, and then came racing wildly on again to where my manuscript was not yet dry, and paused again, and either drank or smelt with loathing, for again it turned to fly. Plainly with an intelligence I dealt. It seemed too tiny to have room for feet, yet must have had a set of them complete to express how much it didn't want to die. It ran with terror and with cunning crept, It faltered. I could see it hesitate, and then, in the middle of the open sheet, cower down in desperation to accept whatever I accorded it of fate. I have none of the tenderer than thou, collectivistic, regimenting love with which the modern world is being swept. But this poor microscopic item now, since it was nothing I knew evil of, I let it lie there till I hope it slept. I have a mind myself, and recognize mind when I meet with it in any guise. No one can know how glad I am to find on any sheet the least display of mind. This was one of Frost's subtle, maybe not so subtle, ways of getting back at some of his contemporary poets who, through his career, frequently chided him because Frost wrote very measured, metered, rhyming, kind of traditional poetry. And folks would say to him, you know, Robert, you know, get with the plan here, you know, it's the era of free verse and license, and do whatever you want. To which his response was, free verse, and it's like playing tennis with the net down. Now, what's the challenge? He liked the challenge of finding the meter, finding the scan, finding the rhyme, and he puts together words that you would never think of rhyming, and they come together just in a marvelous way. Well, I'm thinking of how we segue into this next poem. I can't think of any good way, so we'll just do it. It's called Fire and Ice, maybe one of Frost's better known poems. Back to dealing with the ultimate. You know, we go from the considerable speck to the grand scheme of creation. Fire and Ice. Some say the world will end in fire. Some say in ice. From what I've tasted of desire, I'd hold with those who favor fire. But if it had to perish twice, I think I know enough of hate to say that for destruction, ice is also great and would suffice. Well, we'll go back to the insect world for a minute. Here's a poem that puts some words together. Along about the middle of the poem, listen carefully. There are some words in here that I didn't even know what they meant, let alone think of rhyming them. You'll catch them as we go along. The title of the poem is called Departmental, and it carried a subtitle with it called The Death of My Aunt Jerry, but it's Aunt, A-N-T. He's talking about insects and commenting on how insects run their lives, but with a rather sharp point again at the end. Departmental. An ant on the tablecloth ran into a dormant moth of many times his size. He showed not the least surprise, his business wasn't with such. He gave it scarcely a touch and was off on his duty rough. Yet, if he encountered one of the hive's inquiry squad, whose work it is to find out God and the nature of time and space, he would put him onto the case. Ants are a curious race. One crossing with hurried tread the body of one of its dead, isn't given a moment's rest, seems not even impressed. But he no doubt reports to any with whom he crosses antennae, and they no doubt report to the higher up at court. Then the word goes forth informic. Death's come to Jerry McCormick. Our selfless forager Jerry will the special Janissary, whose office it is to bury the dead of the commissary, go bring him home to his people. Lay him in state on a sepal, wrap him for shroud in a petal, embalm him with ichor of metal. This is the word of your queen. And presently on the scene appears a solemn mortician, and taking formal position with feelers calmly a twiddle, he seizes him by the middle, and heaving him high in the air, he carries him out of there. Well, no one stands round to stare, it's nobody else's affair. It couldn't be called ungentle, but how thoroughly departmental. Thank you. One of the stories that I've heard attached to that poem is that Frost recited it on a goodwill trip to the Soviet Union. And after he had a bit of an encounter with how the bureaucracy there works, or maybe we should say doesn't work, he chided some of the Soviet officials with that, and as I understand it, they laughed very appropriately with him. Well, away from humor for a minute and step into some of a little bit of the more serious side of Robert Frost. This next poem is one that is especially dear to my heart as a pastor and a pastoral counselor. This poem is very brief, but it speaks volumes about empathy and what it means to really feel for someone else. It's called Lodged. The rain to the wind said, "You push and I'll pelt." And they so smote the garden bed that the flowers actually knelt and lay there lodged, though not dead. I know how the flowers felt. People often refer to Robert Frost as a nature poet, which was a title that he did not want, and always pointed out that you would find almost none of his poems that did not either have a human character, a human voice, or some human theme in them. And I think this little poem, Lodged, is an excellent example of that. Yes, it's about nature, the wind and the rain and the flowers and so forth, but it's undeniably human. You know, the human feeling comes through so clearly. And I think this is what Frost was such a master at, taking the common experience, but saying it in an uncommon way. That's one of the things that he liked to say he really thrived on. Well, to what I think is my favorite Robert Frost poem, Birches, partly because it has a line in it about baseball, and I like baseball, but more than that, this is another poem that really probes the depths of what it means to be human. You have to get yourself in a frame of mind where you can hear this poem spoken by an old man who's thinking back to his youth. That'll become clearer as we get to the end of the poem, but think of it in that framework. Birches. You should stand up. When I see birches bend to left and right across the lines of straighter, darker trees, I like to think some boy's been swinging them. But swinging doesn't bend them down to stay, as ice storms do. Often you must have seen them loaded with ice a sunny winter morning after a rain. They click upon themselves as the breeze rises and turn many colored as the stir cracks and crazes their enamel, shattering and avalanching on the snow crust such heaps of broken glass to sweep away, you'd think the inner dome of heaven had fallen. They are dragged to the withered bracken by the load, and they seem not to break, though once bowed so low for long, they never right themselves. You may see their trunks arching in the woods years afterwards, trailing their leaves on the ground like girls on hands and knees that throw their hair before them over their heads to dry in the sun. But I was going to say, when truth broke in with all her matter of fact about the ice storm, that I should prefer to have some boy bend them. As he went out and in to fetch the cows, some boy too far from town to learn baseball, whose only play was what he learned himself and could play alone. One by one, he subdued his father's trees by riding them down over and over again until he took the stiffness out of them. And not one but hung limp. Not one was left for him to conquer. He learned all there was for him to learn about not launching out too soon and so not carrying the tree away clear to the ground. He always kept his poise, climbing carefully to the top branches with the same pains you use to fill a cup up to the brim and even above the brim. And then he flung outward, feet first with a swish, kicking his way down through the air to the ground. So was I once, myself, a swinger of birches. And so I dream of going back to be. It's when I'm weary of consideration and life is too much like a pathless wood where your face burns and tickles from the cobwebs having broken across it, and one eye is weeping from a twig having lashed across it open. I'd like to get away from earth a while and then come back to it and begin over. May no fate willfully misunderstand me and half grant what I wish and whisk me away not to return. Earth's the right place for love. I can't imagine where it's likely to go better. I'd like to go by climbing a birch tree, climb black branches up a snow-white trunk till the tree could bear no more but dipped its top and set me down again. That would be good, both going and coming back. One could do worse and be a swinger of birches. Need a little water after all that preaching over there at Vespers tonight, you know, do this black preaching straight to the voice. Birches does such a beautiful job of claiming that part of ourselves that desperately wants to hold on to the beautiful moments in life and the innocent moments, the childhood moments, and we cherish those things. But in this next poem called Nothing Gold Can Stay, you know, we're here to embrace the contraries, and here's one of them. Frost points out that you can't hang on to those things. The best you can do is cherish those moments while you have them, enjoy them, and inevitably they're going to fade into the next chapter. Nothing gold can stay. Nature's first green is gold, her hardest hue to hold. Her early leaf's a flower, but only for an hour. Then leaf subsides to leaf, so Eden sank to grief. So dawn goes down to day. Nothing gold can stay. Well, one of the contraries of Robert Frost is he could write one poem saying one thing, turn right around and give you another poem that beautifully says it from the other side, which we're about to see in this next poem called Provide, Provide. On the one hand, he's just told us you can't hang on and you can't take it with you. Now he's about to tell us maybe you can. To understand this poem, we need to understand one biblical character, and maybe somebody can help us out. Do you know who the person of Abishag was in the Bible? Who she was? Anybody? Margie?
Well, she supposedly is the woman in the Song of Songs, probably the Shunammite girl.
Yeah, and do you remember why they brought her to David as his wife when he was very old? And
warm.
Yeah, to keep him warm. Yeah, the most beautiful woman in the kingdom, it was said. And because poor King David was in ill health, you know, the medicinal purposes only, of course, to keep him warm. Well, if knowing that, it helps you understand the first verse of this poem, Provide, Provide. Written, as I understand it, when there was a workers' strike going on in Boston, and Frost wrote to out of some sympathy for these workers. The witch that came, the withered hag, to wash the steps with pail and rag, was once the beauty Abishag, the picture pride of Hollywood. Too many fall from great and good for you to doubt the likelihood. Die early and avoid the fate. Or, if predestined to die late, make up your mind to die in state. Make the whole stock exchange your own. If need be, occupy a throne where nobody can call you crone. Some have relied on what they knew, others on being simply true. What worked for them might work for you. No memory of having starred atones for later disregard or keeps the end from being hard. Better to go down dignified with boughten friendship at your side than none at all. Provide. Or as I've heard that Frost was wont to say, somebody else will provide for you, and how would you like that? Gosh. Well, next poem, Mending Wall. We shared it a week or so ago in Vespers, for those of you who are here. It's an often misquoted and misunderstood poem of Robert Frost. You all know the line, you know, good fences make good neighbors. And when you only get that line out of context, it's often thought that Frost was saying, you know, fences are important, boundaries are crucial, space is to be cherished, and so forth. But you'll see that the real thrust of this poem is to say, why? I mean, why do we have walls? We shared it in Vespers in the context of the Ephesians passage, Jesus being the one who has broken down the dividing wall of hostility. And I like to think of this poem in that regard. Mending Wall. Something there is that doesn't love a wall, that sends the frozen groundswell under it and spills the upper boulders in the sun and makes gaps that even two could pass abreast. The work of hunters is another thing. I've come after them and made repair, for they've left not one stone on a stone. But they would have the rabbit out of hiding to please the yelping dogs. The gaps, I mean, no one has seen them made or heard them made, but at spring mending time, we find them there. I let my neighbor know beyond the hill, and on a day we meet to walk the line and set the wall between us once again. To each, the boulders that have fallen to each. Some are loaves, and some so nearly balls we have to use a spell to make them balance. Stay where you are till our backs are turned. We wear our fingers rough with handling them. Just another kind of outdoor game, one on a side. It comes to little more. There where it is, we do not need a wall. He is all pine tree, and I am apple orchard. My apple trees will never get across and eat the cones under his pines, I tell him. He only says, good fences make good neighbors. Spring is the mischief in me, and I wonder if I could put a notion in his head. Why do they make good neighbors? Isn't it where there are cows? But here, we have no cows. Before I built a wall, I'd ask to know what I was walling in or walling out, and to whom I was like to give offense. Something there is that doesn't love a wall, that wants it down. I could say elves to him, but it isn't elves exactly, and I'd rather he said it for himself. I see him there, bringing a stone grasped firmly by the top in each hand like an old stone savage armed. He moves in darkness, as it seems to me, not of woods only and shade of trees, but he will not go behind his father's saying. And he likes having thought of it so well, he says again, good fences make good neighbors. Ready for another contrary? Lest we think that Frost was, you know, totally altruistic and full of all this good-hearted charity toward his neighbors, here comes this next poem, Trespass. Totally different mindset. No, I'd set no prohibiting sign. And yes, the land was hardly fenced. Nevertheless, the land was mine. I was being trespassed on and against. Whoever the surly freedom took of such an unaccountable stay, busying by my woods and brook, gave me a strangely restless day. He might be opening Leaves of Stone, the picture book of the trilobite for which the region round was known, and in which there was little property right. It was not the value I stood to lose in specimen crab and specimen rock, but his ignoring what was whose that made me look again at the clock. Then came his little acknowledgement. He asked for a drink at the kitchen door. An errand he may have had to invent, but it made my property mine once more. Well, we're heading down the home stretch here. We've had Frost talking with lots of different things, everything from bugs to plants and flowers, but in this poem, Take Something Like a Star, here's Frost in conversation with the universe. And by the way, I should take the time to plug my own creation here. Nine years ago when I was here in the village, I had some time to write a little devotional on the poems of Robert Frost. You can still find it, I discovered, in the bookstore. It's tucked way down in a corner down there by the poetry books, off on one side. You got to look for it, but I think there are still a few copies. The centerfold is a wonderful drawing that David Martin, who was in the village at that time and a great artist, did of the universe in conjunction with his poem, Take Something Like a Star. So you might want to take a look. O star, the fairest one in sight, we grant your loftiness the right to some obscurity of cloud. It will not do to say of night, for dark is what brings out your light. Some mystery becomes the proud. But to be wholly taciturn in your reserve is not allowed. Say something to us we can learn by heart, when alone repeat. Say something. And it says, I burn. But say with what degree of heat? Talk Fahrenheit, talk centigrade. Use language we can comprehend. Tell us what elements you blend. It gives us strangely little aid, but does tell something in the end. And steadfast as Keats' Eremite, not even stooping from its sphere, it asks a little of us here. It asks of us a certain height. So when at times the mob is swayed to carry praise or blame too far, we may take something like a star to stay our minds on and be stayed. Well, there are several poems without which no presentation of Robert Frost's poetry would be complete, and we need to share those. The next is The Road Not Taken. Probably at least one of two or three that are the most well-known of Robert Frost's poems. I ask you to listen to it with perhaps a different ear. I had become acquainted with this poem for a long time before I read someone's observation on it, that we don't really know, on the basis of the text itself, whether the poet is happy or sad about the choice that's made. It's just not clear by the end. All we know is that a choice has been made, and as he said, that's made all the difference. But what kind of difference? That's up to you, that's up to me. And that's the genius of Robert Frost, I think, who invites us into the poem. It becomes our poem. We find our own way, and we make our own meaning. The Road Not Taken. Two roads diverged in a yellow wood, and sorry, I could not be one traveler, and travel both. Long I stood, and looked down one as far as I could to where it bent in the undergrowth. And then took the other as just as fair, and having perhaps the better claim, because it was grassy and wanted wear. Though as for that, the passing there had worn them really about the same. And both that morning equally lay in leaves no step had trodden black. Oh, I saved the first for another day. Yet, knowing how way leads on to way, I doubted if I should ever come back. I shall be telling this tale with a sigh somewhere, ages and ages hence. Two roads diverged in a wood, and I took the one less traveled by, and that has made all the difference. And the other poem of Robert Frost, which you could hardly do a program of his poetry without, is Stopping by Woods on a Snowy Evening. Frost liked to say that poetry was written in a state of grace. I guess a lot of good things in life happen when you're in that state of grace. He claimed that things simply came to him in a flash of inspiration, and claimed that he wrote this next poem in a very few minutes, after he had worked long into the night writing a long, long narrative poem called New Hampshire, in which there's a great line that says, how does it go? "'Tis pleasant to be thinking of New Hampshire. At present, I'm living in Vermont." Anyway, he claimed that after writing this poem, he went outside, and there was the snow and so forth, and out came this poem. I later discovered, in working through some critical text, that there are actually about 5 revisions of this poem, and they're all in the archives at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor, and he lied, basically, I think. He did not write this poem in one fell swoop. But the point is well taken, that one acts and writes in a state of grace, and I think maybe this is where this poem leads us. Stopping by Woods on a Snowy Evening. Whose woods these are, I think I know. His house is in the village, though he will not see me stopping here to watch his woods fill up with snow. My little horse must think it queer to stop without a farmhouse near between the woods and frozen lake the darkest evening of the year. He gives his harness bells a shake to ask if there is some mistake. The only other sounds the sweep of easy wind and downy flake. The woods are lovely, dark, and deep. But I have promises to keep, and miles to go before I sleep, and miles to go before I sleep. Well, I used to like to close a program with that poem, but decided tonight to use one other poem to wrap things up with. We started with that little poem, The Pasture, you may remember. I think I forgot to say that it was essentially a love poem. He wrote that poem for his wife, going out to clean the pasture spring, "You Come Too," poem of invitation. So we close with what I think is equally a love poem. My wife likes it a lot, so this is for you. It's called Yoda Subscript, and if you've never studied Greek, maybe... Wow. And you write it as a little slash mark under the word, and that's called the Yoda subscript. Well, Frost, who was himself well-versed in the classics, knew Latin and Greek, taught them both, picked up on that and thought, isn't that fascinating, you know? The letter that drops out and, as it were, becomes subservient to the other letters is the letter I. And if you'll notice in this little book, if you have a chance to look at the cover, David did a wonderful job of dropping out the I on every occasion and making it a little subscript. Yoda subscript. "Seek not in me the big I capital, nor the little dotted in me seek. If I have in me any I at all, 'tis the Yoda subscript of the Greek. So small am I as an attention beggar that the letter I am subscript to is neither alpha, eta, nor omega, but upsilon, which is the Greek for you." I'll share one last bit of rhyme with you, and it's not a full poem, but it's the last couple lines of a long poem called A Lesson for Today. I think it sums up most everything that the life of Robert Frost was about. I would claim this certainly as words for myself, and I'd hope we all could. And were an epitaph to be my story, I'd have a short one ready for my own. I would have written of me on my stone, he had a lover's quarrel with the world. Thank you very much. Thank you.